The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So for the first time since 2005, the quarterfinals of the Champions League will happen without Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. An exhibition of how not to be in a wall from Ronaldo helps Porto squeeze in a free kick in extra time to see off Juve, while a glorious strike from Messi, not enough as PSG managed to hold on to their slender first leg lead. A home win for Liverpool in Budapest. Fabinho is excellent as he has controversially played in midfield. Should Klopp's men now throw all their eggs into the Champions League basket? Dortmund are through. Seven wild minutes of VAR, a highlight in another great game. Erling Braut Haaland still good. We'll check in with the Premier League. Man City see off a spirited Southampton. We'll look ahead to the weekend, dip our toes into the water of pod merchandise, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, from the Racing Post, Mark Langdon. Hello.
Hi, Max.
Barry Glendenning, welcome back.
Thank you. This is the first conversation or meaningful contact I've had with other human beings for 4 days, so I might be a bit rusty when it comes to actual conversation.
I think you've started brilliantly. Paul says, did Barry miss the last two pods as he had to make arrangements for Max's wife's return?
Oh, she's back tomorrow, isn't she? Very exciting.
Yeah. Well, I thought you knew. On your birthday as well, Barry, if everyone can remember to wish Barry a happy birthday for tomorrow. Jonathan Liu makes up the panel. Hey, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Are you well?
Yeah, pretty good. I've had a quite traumatic morning, actually. We didn't have enough milk for my cereal. Oh. But we did have enough milk for tea, but I'd poured what milk I had into my cereal and then had to sieve the cereal, like pour it into a sieve and get the milk out. So to put it in the very unsatisfying. And I now have tea with muesli in it.
How far away from the nearest milk emporium do you live?
A 12-minute round trip.
I mean, I find when I'm listening to podcasts, when they try and do fun stuff before the serious bit, I get a bit annoyed about it. I'm like, look, I'm happy for you to do that, but I've listened to this specifically for football, so...
I would recommend, Max, then, that you don't listen to Ellis James's socially distant sports bar, where there can often be up to an hour of frivolous, non-sport-related banter before they get even touch on any of the stuff they're supposed to be discussing.
Yeah, but we're the leading football podcast, Barry. People come to us for...
Yeah, but theirs is better than ours.
Oh, well, that's okay. Liverpool 2, RB Leipzig 0. So Liverpool go through 4-0 on aggregate. Paul says, if Liverpool lose again tonight, can you not talk about it so I can listen to the pod? It's been months since I last listened. Well, welcome, Paul.
Sorry, this is an interesting thing I've noticed, and Paul is not alone in this, that some people, if their team has lost, A, won't watch Match of the Day, and B, won't listen to any podcasts about football purely because their team didn't win a game. I find that very odd.
Well, I can't look at a league table if Cambridge don't win. When I look at, I sort of look away. I don't stare. When Cambridge have won, I stare at the league table for hours. But I don't really like to look at it for a few days if Cambridge have lost. Mark, where do you stand on all of this?
I'm with that listener, actually. I would say if I support Tottenham. If Spurs lose, then I'll give the podcast a wide berth until they at least get a draw.
What is it you're afraid of hearing?
I've seen it. I don't need to be told again, about what Mourinho's done wrong and how Man City have ripped them apart. I just don't need to hear it again. I'd just rather blank it out and try to focus on other things.
Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, I could totally empathise with that. I mean, if you just don't want to relive it. It's not, obviously there's things you can learn, but just bringing back all these bad memories. It's like whenever I have a bad week in fantasy football, I won't log back onto the website for about 2 or 3 weeks because it just brings back so many bad memories of all the disasters that I kind of sympathize with.
But
that.
They're poor decisions you've made. If your football team loses, it's not your fault.
You could argue that supporting Spurs is a pretty bad decision in itself.
This is a very Spursy podcast, isn't it? People, all sorts of people will see through this with the agendas that we trot out in the next hour or so. Well, look, with apologies and full credit to all the RB Leipzig fans who are going to listen to us talk about RB Leipzig going out of the Champions League. Johnny, it was a really good performance from Liverpool. You've written about Fabinho today, and they played him in midfield, and he was really good there.
Yeah, it was one of those where, in a weird way, the two goals Liverpool scored were kind of the icing on the cake, really. They were so good and efficient in stopping Leipzig from doing what they wanted to do that it quickly became clear that Leipzig didn't really have two goals in them. And yeah, Fabinho, first start in the centre of midfield since October, I think, and for various reasons, injury, and obviously he's been moved into defence. And it was incredible just how much they looked like a more functional team and how much he improved the players around him. Wijnaldum was able to play a bit further forward. Thiago had a bit more licence to get forward, and, you know, without having to chase and do as much defensive work, because Fabinho, which he hoovers balls up. His reading of the game is superb. And you know, even when he doesn't quite get to the ball, he just gets enough contact on it. You know, he blocks the path of the runner or just gives them a little body check, and he slows down opposition teams, and he's incredibly efficient at kind of stopping the other team playing. And I think Liverpool have been missing that over the last few months, where they've kind of gone from bad to worse. They've missed that real concussive presence in midfield that just stops opposition teams in their track and moves them back into an attacking mindset. So yeah, I mean, they looked a completely different team last night, and I think, you know, Salah and Mane getting a goal as well was good for their confidence. They're not out of the woods yet by any stretch of the imagination, but there's positive signs there, I think.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But does this suggest, Mark, that Klopp shouldn't have put those midfielders in defence and should have just sort of taken the calculated risk the other way, i.e. you're better off having Henderson or Fabinho or both, and just see what Nat Phillips and Kabak and all the others can do at centre-back?
Well, I think Fabinho actually played quite well at centre-back, certainly initially when he first went back there. And I think had Liverpool lost games where maybe Fabinho was in midfield and it was maybe Thiago on the bench and you had Nat Phillips playing at centre-back, then people would have said exactly the same thing. Said, well, you know, why don't you get Thiago in the team? Get your best players there and, you know, just move Fabinho back. So I tend to think it's probably Liverpool's poor form is probably a consequence of quite a lot of little things that have just all gone wrong together, and that was just one of them. I mean, even down to the front three. I mean, in the first half against Leipzig, they missed chances that ordinarily, you know, that they would have taken, and I think it was massive that they, as well as the clean sheet, that particularly Mane got back on the score sheet, because he hasn't looked like the Mane of kind of previous years at Liverpool. So hopefully from Liverpool's point of view, the confidence of a clean sheet and Mane particularly getting on the score sheet, I think will be important for them.
So you saying that Klopp thought it would be better to have more expensive square pegs in round holes than more rudimentary round pegs in round holes?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and also, I mean, I've not been convinced by some of those centre-backs that have been playing. I mean, Nat Phillips, I mean, he's somebody that wasn't even in the Champions League squad until they were able to change it. I mean, he was playing on loan in the second division in Germany not that long ago. So I'm still not entirely convinced that he's maybe at that level to play for Liverpool. He did fine last night. And Kabak as well wasn't signed until quite recently. So I think there are sort of circumstances that are easy to understand, I think, why Klopp did what he did.
Barry, Liverpool are eighth, 7 points off the top four. The sides fifth, sixth and seventh all have a game in hand on them. They prioritised this game against Leipzig ahead of the Fulham game because, you know, they rested a lot of players for that Fulham game that they lost. Should they go all out for the Champions League? All out to win this one? Because that would mean sort of sacrificing arguably four games in April.
I don't think they're good enough to win it, to be honest. I thought they played well last night. Nat Phillips was pretty immense in the centre-half position. But like Mark, I'd say one swallow doesn't make a summer. I think last night he got bandage points because he had a black bandage on his head. That always makes centre-halves look more heroic. If it had been white and blood-soaked, we'd be talking much more about how great he was. Let's not go mad. Axel Tuanzebe was lauded to the high heavens, and rightly so, for a brilliant performance against PSG earlier this season. He's not in the Manchester United team now. I don't think a team with a centre-half pairing of Ozan Kabak and Nat Phillips is good enough to win the Champions League. RB Leipzig, I thought, brought very little to the party last night. Mark will know better than me, because he'll have seen Nagelsmann teams play a lot more often than I have, but in the 10 or so matches I've seen Nagelsmann teams play, I've been hugely underwhelmed, and I just don't get this lauding of him as this the messiah of football, German football management. I really don't get it, because I've almost always been underwhelmed by his team's performance, and they've often lost, and lost heavily.
Mark, could you whelm Barry?
Well, I think from Leipzig's point of view, they it's a bit rabbit in the headlights when they're in the Champions League playing against these sort of more established teams in Europe. And I do think that they kind of have this fear factor against, you know, even Manchester United, just because of their grand history, when they haven't really got any, and they haven't got that many players that have played at that level too often. And I feel like that there is an inferiority complex when they go up against some of these big teams, and they maybe don't show their true worth. When they played Bayern Munich in the Bundesliga earlier on this season and drew 3-3, you know, that was a thrilling game where they did play sort of on the front foot and showed much more about themselves. And, you know, they are pushing Bayern for the Bundesliga title this year. Bayern are among the favourites for the Champions League. They're only a couple of points behind them. I do think from Leipzig's point of view, they maybe lack a bit of creativity sort of in that number 10 position. They've got a lot of fast players, and that's the way that they like to sort of create, if you like. But they haven't got maybe that guile to just open up a team, even one that's weakened like Liverpool. And Timo Werner's departure to Chelsea has left them without a sort of proper, elite goal scorer. And maybe Werner not been quite so elite in the Premier League, but he was for Leipzig. And so it's kind of this holistic approach to attacking where players move around, and, you know, if Poulsen's not playing, he's the target man, then kind of Forsberg might pop up into that centre forward position, or Olmo might run forward. And it's just a way that they're trying to play without Timo Werner. They found that it would just be impossible to on their kind of footballing model, it was impossible for them to replace Timo Werner, and they've tried to do it in a different way. And I think they've probably just been shown up that not quite good enough nor ready for this level.
PSG are through. They drew 1-1 with Barca last night, 5-2 on aggregate. Barca were on a run of 13 consecutive quarterfinal appearances, the longest run in the competition's history. The last time they were knocked out at this stage, 2006-07 by Liverpool. Let's talk about Lionel Messi's goal first, Johnny. What a wonderful thing that was.
Yeah, and I think the context was everything there. I mean, it was a few minutes earlier, I think. I mean, Ousmane Dembele, who missed, I think, so many chances in that half. And you just saw in those opening stages, Messi just sort of teeing up Dembele missing. And I don't know, he just gets the ball out right. I'm going to do this myself. Just leathers it into the top corner. But when you think of Messi goals, you don't really think of, you know, the 25-yard pile drive. Obviously, he scored plenty. But there was a real, I think, catharsis to that. It's just, I'm just going to have a go. And it was thrilling, and lovely little dip at the end. I like shots that look like they're just about to head on over the bar, and then kind of dip in the last minute. Very aesthetically pleasing.
It was a shame he missed that penalty, because it would have set up a brilliant second half. Mbappe became the youngest player to reach 25 goals in the Champions League, taking the mantle from Lionel Messi. I mean, he won't hold it for long with Erling Braut Haaland, will he? But a lot of this game, Barry, is been about Barcelona and the Messi crisis, but we probably need to credit Pochettino and PSG. Does Poch being there make you like PSG a tiny bit more, Barry?
No.
Do you want to give them any credit anyway?
I thought they did their damnedest to blow this. I mean, they could have been absolutely swamped in the first half, probably should have been. Ousmane Dembele. I think Messi must just privately and possibly publicly curse him. But I imagine Maurizio Pochettino gave his PSG players quite the rollicking at halftime. They were much improved in the second half, but Barcelona will see that, and it was an uncharacteristically excellent Barcelona performance in the first half compared to most of the season, but just their finishing really let them down, and we could have had another massive PSG bottle job but for their wayward finishing. So I don't think PSG will win this competition. I don't think they have it in them to win this competition. But
I mean, you say it every year. Yes. I guess one day they might prove you wrong. But
I say it every year, and I'm always right. But, you know, the Champions League, it's very hard to win. It's really difficult to win the Champions League. So you could argue there's no shame in not winning it. But given the amount they spend on it and given how obsessed they are with winning it, I just find it hilarious that they're not able to.
Mark, can we talk about the PSG penalty? By the letter of the law, it's a penalty. Intent doesn't matter. Lars has told me that enough times. It's Longley clipping Icardi's heel. The ball is going into the keeper's hands. I just think everybody who likes football and knows about football thinks that that shouldn't be a penalty, yet we kind of accept it is a penalty. And I don't want to accept it anymore. I want a plaque. I want to march somewhere, Mark. I want to take a placard and a torch and yell at someone about it.
Yeah, but not every contact has to be a penalty anyway. I mean, there was minimal contact. I know it was accidental and that doesn't matter. But I mean, that, I must like football then, Max, because I agree with you, and I would like to see this stopped. And when you spoke earlier about Mbappe breaking records, I mean, if those are going to be given as penalties for the next 10 to 15 years, then it won't be long before somebody breaks Haaland's record in terms of becoming the youngest Champions League goal scorer to hit 20 goals or whatever it is, because you're just going to get too many opportunities to be given an 80% chance of scoring a goal. I'd find it all a bit of a nonsense. I mean, the much kind of bigger disgrace on the VAR from that game was the fact that the English officials, I'm not sure which one it was, but yeah, to miss the Verratti encroachment when Messi's penalty was saved. I mean, that feels to me like, you know, an even bigger injustice really than that pen.
Yeah, I mean, although I don't mind him being, Verratti being there particularly as a law, but you're right, if you're going to have VAR, do it right. I'm increasingly desperate for VAR to end, and I know that we're going to talk about it a lot, obviously, with the Dortmund Sevilla game. But Johnny, you wanted to.
Well, one of the big bugbears that people had before VAR came in was that off the ball fouls were routinely unpunished because referees just didn't see them. And this is one of the, you know, one of the consequences of VAR is that these fouls, whether they're kind of, you know, a little shirt pull or a little trip, you know, which we saw, you know, last night, was that they are now being punished with penalties. And the fact that people are now going, oh no, well, that's not a penalty. That doesn't look like a penalty. That shouldn't be a penalty because that doesn't correspond with my view of what a penalty was in the golden days before VAR, when people talked to their neighbours and we used to get the milkman used to come up, you know, and people were polite to each other. And there were only four channels on TV and we just watched them because, you know, that's what there was to watch, and things were just better and we all just got on with each other. I feel like I do this every time I come on here, but that was a foul. It was a foul. It was a soft foul. It was a cheap foul. But if you trip a player up in the penalty area, it is a penalty. If it doesn't look like a penalty to somebody who's been watching football for 30 years, that's kind of not the issue with the rules, is it?
I get your point, Johnny. You're right. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm just showing my age, but I don't want that to be a penalty.
But that's more hassle. So you have to judge intent, and you have to judge whether that is good, you know, and those are both two more subjective decisions.
Sure. Or we just don't have VAR because it wasn't actually, on balance, it wasn't that bad before.
No, it was. Like,
was
yeah,
it?
Referees used to get used to make howlers. Players used to get used to score goals when they were 2 yards offside. It was a nightmare. And people used to say, "We should have VAR."
But do you actually think it's better now?
I think there's a bit of a transition period where the technology will improve and people will become more accustomed to it, and the game will adapt. And in a few years' time, we won't be talking about this.
I don't want to be a football dinosaur, though. So that's the,
the thing is, Max. The VAR call we're going to talk about in the Dortmund game, every decision made was correct, but it took 6 minutes. And
I don't think they were. I don't think Haaland fouls the defender at all. I just think the defender tries to foul him and just is half the size of this superhuman. Anyway, let's end part one. Part two, we'll get on to Dortmund Sevilla. Before that, we'll do Porto beating Juventus on away goals. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, Juventus 3, Porto 2, Porto through on away goals. What a brilliant game of football. Porto hanging on for so long with 10 men after Ahmedi Taremi was sent off early in the second half. Cuadrado hitting the bar in injury time. That free kick going in from miles out. Ronaldo turning his back on the free kick. Rabiot scoring seconds later. It had everything, didn't it, Barry?
Yes, it did. And you've just described everything that happened, so I'm not sure what is left for me to say.
Do you know what I felt, Barry, was I felt like I'd earned that game because I'd watched so much football recently that's been rubbish. You know, that Sunday where you and I were in the TalkSport office with West Brom Newcastle on one screen and Dundee United Celtic on another screen, and there were no goals, and it was just so... I just thought, just like... I needed it.
You deserve it, hon.
It sort of cleansed me. It made me, like, I was just off my seat. I was enjoying it.
Well, I'll be, you know, I think I've said it before. I've fed up with the Premier League at this stage because there's not a huge amount going on in it and the schedule is grueling. But I'm loving the Champions League knockout stages. I always do. If we could find some way of getting rid of the group stages, that would be even better. But
or we could make the group stages longer, Barry, if you want. I mean,
well, I presume we'll get to that.
Yeah, we will. Mark, what did you make of this?
I was feeling very fatigued after the weekend. When you go from Wolves' trip to Aston Villa and that West Brom game and various others, I mean, it did feel like it had become hard work. Even when I was watching Inter against Atalanta on Monday, it's supposed to be a really big game in Italy, and Inter won 1-0, and it wasn't as good as I hoped for, and I was starting to just wonder, you know, what was the point of any of it. And then that game on Tuesday was magnificent. It was easily the best game of the season in terms of like enjoyment. Had the perfect result with Juventus going out to a smaller team that Juventus' owners wouldn't even want to see at that stage of the Champions League. And I felt as well that Porto absolutely deserved it over the two legs. Conceição had completely outcoached Pirlo in the first game, and even for much of the second one, Juventus were not good in that game. Until the second half, and they were playing against 10 men, they started to move the ball a bit quicker. But it doesn't make any sense to me when you've bet the farm on Cristiano Ronaldo and you're paying him this extortionate wage, and you've got maybe one more year left of him, that you just take a massive gamble and employ somebody that until a week before he got the job, you know, literally wasn't involved in football and didn't appear to have much interest in becoming a coach. Then he was appointed youth team coach. A week later, he's managing the first team. And for a team like Juventus that seemed to put so much into their planning and efficiency, to have left themselves so short just feels like a really strange and odd move. And, you know, they were good and, you know, I suppose more experienced and better coaches out there to have just got them maybe into a better position with the team that they've got, because the rebuild will have to start at some stage. But if you're paying Ronaldo that kind of money, you've probably got to put the pieces in place around him to give yourself the best chance of success.
How well did Pirlo do in that week in the youth team? Did he do stunningly well? Changed the DNA.
No, I think he had a picture taken on social media while he was still away, and then that was it. I mean, it clearly wasn't the plan. You don't employ somebody to be the youth team coach and then a week later make him the first team coach, because if you wanted him to be the first team coach, then you would have just waited, wouldn't you, and then appointed him in that position. I think that the job that Allegri and Sarri did previously, probably looking a lot better now, particularly Allegri, maybe stylistically wasn't what Juventus wanted from a manager, but he certainly got better results. And the other issue with Ronaldo, apart from him sort of jumping out of the way of that wall, is that he offers the team absolutely nothing defensively. And so if you do, you know, if Pirlo has got this grand plan to try to win the ball back high and, you know, a more modern approach, if you like, you can't do that with Cristiano Ronaldo, because it's not something he can do at his age. And I'm not sure he wanted to do it that much when he was younger either, really. So they had to build a team around him, and I don't think they've done that well enough.
It's also worth noting, Max, that for that free kick, they elected not to have anyone in the draft excluder / skirting board role, and that cost them the goal.
Absolutely. And known as the crocodile, apparently, in Italy. I mean, that, you know, obviously the biggest crime in football is turning your back. I mean, that's you know, sort of worse than murder, isn't it? But Ronaldo's effort in the wall...
I would argue, though, that getting hit in the face by a football or the knackers really hurts, Max.
It does.
I mean, how badly do you want to win the Champions League? He's won it before. Yeah, and if you get hit full force in the face with a football, winning the Champions League is the last thing on your mind. You just don't care.
We did this text topic on the radio yesterday, stories from the wall, and one bloke said a particularly hungover day. They all turned up on Sunday league, and the opposition had a centre forward who could kick the ball really hard, and they got a free kick, and they all stood in the wall, and then the referee had to bring them 5 yards forwards because for the first time ever, they'd gone far too far back. Johnny, Pepe was absolutely brilliant. He has annoyed me in the past, but he is a brilliant defender. 38, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, for some reason, it's just a lot more fun seeing Pepe being a shithouse for Porto than it ever was seeing him do it for Portugal or Real Madrid. He's clearly taken care of himself. He's got, you know, incredible amount of experience at this level, and in those key moments during that game when Juventus was kind of flapping about a bit. You know, you could almost see them thinking, well, it's happening again. You know, was it Lyon last season? It was Ajax the season before that, and you could just see them going to pieces slightly. And Porto just, you know, in both legs actually stuck to their task so well. And you know, obviously it was a huge team effort for all of them. But it is nice to see Pepe just kind of, you know, still doing it at this level.
Who else stood out for you, Mark? Because, you know, this starting 11 is not a set of household names for a lot of people.
No, I mean, I think Pepe was the star, I suppose, in terms of he had 18 clearances in the match, which is incredible figure. I suppose Oliveira, who got the goal, the free kick, I think outside of that was still, over the course of the game. I mean, he was somebody that you feel could definitely sort of, you know, next to Porto model, I suppose, you know, to sell players. So, I mean, he was somebody that could, I think, step up. But I think it was more a victory for the team effort as much as anything. And the way I mentioned earlier there that Sergio Conceição had coached them into sort of being more than each individual. And we saw when they had the lead that they defended very... They was defending with six players, which isn't always, I suppose, the most appealing to watch, but it felt really fun. And when they did attack, they did try to get men forward as well, even when they were down to 10 men. And even there was one stage when Robbie Savage on British TV was urging Porto to, you know, run the ball into the corner, and they kind of didn't and still wanted to put balls into the box. And it just felt like a super effort just from everybody. But I think the coach was the standout for me.
I kind of liked Robbie Savage saying that this could be Porto's greatest night. There's a team that's won the Champions League twice.
I'm going to make a bold, controversial and unpopular call. I think Robbie Savage is a good co-coms guy. I know he's not everyone's cup of tea. in many aspects of life, but I do find him quite good on cold comms.
His enthusiasm for football matters, the greatest being Ali McCoist as well, but I enjoyed their enthusiasm for that game. Nicky Bandini made a good point about Juventus, that Juventus tried to build a Champions League team, winning team around Ronaldo, but whatever happens tonight, the future of this team is built around Federico Chiesa. So good the last few weeks. He was brilliant in this game. Colin Miller writing, Juventus knocked out of the Champions League in successive seasons by Ajax, Lyon and Porto, three clubs not deemed glamorous enough for the European Super League by Juve chairman Andrea Agnelli. You absolutely love to see it. That was retweeted thousands of times. Pete asks, considering Agnelli's Juventus have won as many European Cups as Nottingham Forest and have been knocked out by Ajax, Lyon and Porto in the past 3 years, why doesn't anyone in European football tell him to wind his neck in? This is the idea of having the Swiss system with more matches, a group stage of one league table, seeded fixtures arranged. So you wouldn't play everyone in the league and there would be a kind of back door for which Paul Hawksby was saying yesterday. It's a bit like, you know, you're in a queue and then somebody from one of the staff just sort of brings you through. You know, you're Liverpool and you finish eighth, but you're like, you're just sort of going past Everton and Aston Villa and West Ham going, sorry, they just asked me to come through, and you get put into the Champions League. Barry, what do you make of this?
I don't think it's a great idea. There seems to be inevitability about it. I mean, at the moment, we have 96 group games every season in the Champions League, which already seems like too many. And I think I read somewhere that this would lead to 100 extra matches, four new game weeks. So they'd be playing Champions League every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which would in turn probably lead to the League Cup being done away with here in the UK. That wouldn't be a particular problem for teams in other countries. It's Agnelli's sense of entitlement, and the general sense of entitlement of big clubs does great. Yesterday, Steve Parish, the Crystal Palace chairman, came out saying this would destroy the English Football League. I think that might be an exaggeration, and I may indeed be exaggerating what he said, but it would certainly cost the Football League clubs money. But then I move to ask if Steve Parish thinks the League Cup is so great, why did Crystal Palace make 11 changes for the only game they played in it this season? I said this on Twitter and a few people said, but he doesn't pick the team. Yeah, but he picks the manager. And if he wants Crystal Palace to challenge for the League Cup, which is realistically the only tournament they have any chance of winning, he should hire a manager who will take it seriously. He seemed to have the best interests of the Football League at heart, but then this is the same Steve Parish who was very dismissive of the notion that Premier League teams should give them a dig out earlier in this pandemic. So I think Steve Parish, in much the same way as Andre Agnelli, he has the interests of his own club at heart, and that's understandable.
Is Agnelli's argument, Johnny, that if they don't do this, that there will be a European, like a breakaway, and then you'd have a kind of, a bit like in darts, like a PDC and a BDO, and some players playing in this European Super League, but not playing in UEFA and FIFA tournaments, and this is the only way to keep the big clubs within the system? Or is that just an argument he's using that might be bollocks?
Well, that's exactly it. And every few years, when this comes back again, and this threat of a European Super League, some giant breakaway, and it's kind of akin to just like somebody like walks into a corner shop and they've got like a little gun pointing out under their shirt. You don't know whether it's a gun or whether it's just a spoon, but you think it might be a gun anyway. So okay, well let's just give them something. Let's give them a few more changes. Let's tweak the format a little bit to make it even more favourable for the biggest club. And I've just been wondering for so long, why don't you just let them go? Let them go and let the big clubs call their bluff. Let them go and form their own stupid little European Super League. Go and play in Euro Disney or something. Your closed league, and see how you do. And see how Juventus with their giant dead flamingo up front, see how they do against just playing like AC Milan and Manchester United every week. And I don't think they would have the courage to actually follow through with it. It's a shakedown. It's a political move that comes along every few years, and UEFA just, you know, say, oh, they put their hands up and say, oh, please don't hurt us, and they just give them a few more concessions. And I just think it's kind of ridiculous. The way that European football has been heading the last few, everybody knows where this ends. You know, that a few years down the line, they'll come and they'll ask for something else. And I just wonder what would happen if you just said, go on then, your players can't play in the World Cup or the Euros. You can go and play in your little Euro Disney League. But I don't think that'll happen.
No, Mark?
Well, yeah, I mean, I totally agree there, because you know, somebody will still have to finish bottom of this Euro Super League, and that's not where any of these teams want to be. And so there will then become the Crystal Palaces of the European Super League, where you know there's somebody that's always in, you know, the bottom half or whatever, or fighting against whether it's a relegation or, you know, just to avoid being in the wooden spoon position. And you know, none of these teams would want to be in that position, would they, where they were kind of seen as bottom half. You know, you would still have your hierarchy, and I don't think, say, Juventus would enjoy, you know, not being part of that top three or four cartel. And so, I mean, you then just get sort of, you know, would you then get sort of another sort of smaller Euro Super League, because that would be unfair to somebody like that. And yeah, I totally agree. Call their bluff and see what they do. I suspect they wouldn't have the courage to go through with it.
Who would be the Burnley of the Euro Super League? The ignominy of
sort of finishing 16th and
having 20% possession and just having two targets. This is the way we've got to play in this league, isn't it? Who would it be? Yeah, probably Atleti, right? Going to be Atleti.
It feels like Atleti. It feels like the sort of thing Atletico would enjoy.
Are they big enough to be allowed in? Are they allowed in?
Yeah, I think they would be. I mean, and Simeone would. Okay. I mean, he's football stylistically not that different from Sean Dyche. So yeah, maybe they could be the Burnley.
Right, Dortmund are through in this Champions League. If there's any point in this Champions League, since it may not exist in the future, who knows? But let's talk about Erling Braut Haaland, because he was great again. He scored 20 in 14 Champions League games. The quickest a player has reached 20 in 10 fewer appearances than the previous record holder, Harry Kane. Charlie says, not so much a question, more an observation. Does anyone feel there's something very Dolph Lundgren in Universal Soldier about Haaland? He's human, but reconstructed in a lab. Rather than intent on killing Jean-Claude Van Damme, he just wants to score endless goals. He every time I see him, Mark, he's extraordinary.
He is. I mean, Lars has spoken before about the fact that he wasn't always this big, and so when he was, you know, wasn't seen as like a target man figure when he was first coming through, and so he did work on other aspects of his game and was actually, you know, technically a very good player, and then kind of had this huge sort of growth spurt that enables him to have that, you know, the cliche sort of, you know, the big man and a good touch and all of that. But he's actually, he'd harnessed other parts of and aspects of his game before he became this kind of, I don't know, almost like a RoboCop type figure. His appreciation to be able to get the tap-ins is one of the things I like most about him, because he scores a lot of goals that look very simple, and yet you always find that it's only the very best players that can sort of get themselves into those positions for the tap-ins. Like, he scored one against Bayern Munich at the weekend. You know, it's just the movement and appreciation of space of where he needs to be. There was a time when he first went to Dortmund when I did wonder whether the hype had got a little bit much, and he's become very much a social media sort of favourite, and sort of did, you know, in his early days at in Austrian football. But you quickly realise that the hype is real, and you know, he is going to go for an enormous fee when he leaves Borussia Dortmund, assuming they sell him before the contract release clause comes into play.
Johnny talked about that stat about, you know, this is the first Champions League that Messi and Ronaldo haven't been in the quarterfinal since 2005. Players obviously don't go on forever. Like, if you think about like Pelé and Maradona, like, we always need a best player in the world. Like, we need to have one, and we're unlikely to. Do you think there'll be like a Haaland and Mbappe, the two best players in the world, or do you think that Messi Ronaldo thing was just extraordinary to have two people so good and so far above everyone else for so long?
I think in terms of their quality and their consistency, they are outliers, and they're always going to be outliers. But there will always be a need for that type of player. The way that the elite game has gone over the last few years, the game has become so systematized at the top level. And there's this increasing feeling that goals and are scored and games are won and trophies are won by teams executing a plan and just executing it again and again to a very high standard. And that's how, you know, that's how goals are scored. And then you have a player like Haaland who, for the first half hour of that Dortmund-Sevilla game, Sevilla were all over them. Dortmund just couldn't get out of their own third. And then Haaland just wins the ball up high, starts a move and finishes off an attack and basically out of nothing just totally turns the complexion of that game. And there will always be a need for players like that. And that's what makes somebody like Haaland so thrilling, and Mbappe in a different way. And players like Messi and Ronaldo, which is also kind of why Lewandowski's never really done it for me at a visceral level, because I see him as much more of a system player. But the appeal of a guy who can just make something happen from nothing, to just bring grace out of a situation in which it looked absolutely improbable that they could do anything like that. A low percentage player, a guy who makes low percentage runs, who takes on low percentage shots. I think that's one of the things that makes football such a thrilling spectacle. This idea that at any moment a guy like that could do something incredible. That's what sustains the game, I think. And that's what keeps people hooked.
He just looks so much bigger and faster than everyone else. I mean, I watched the Bruno versus Tyson documentary on Sky the other day. It's well worth a look if anyone's interested. But there's a scene where Customato has adopted Tyson and he's living in the D'Amato household with Cuss and Mrs. Cuss and the other kids. And he just looks... I guess he's around 15 or 16 at the time, but he just looks really incongruous there because he's so much bigger than everyone else. Watching Haaland the next night just struck me as being slightly similar. But because in that game, Sevilla had more attempts, more shots on target, more possession, but Borussia Dortmund had... Erling Haaland. I felt a little bit sorry for Youssef and Nesri for Sevilla because he also scored two goals in that game, but no one's talking about him.
I watched the Pelé documentary the other day on Netflix, and I think what's interesting, it's obviously too early to put Haaland in this category, right? Because you don't know what's going to happen in the next 10 years. Like the impact that Pelé had on Brazil as a country, right? And the impact that Maradona had on Argentina as a country, sort of beyond sport. Does that still happen? Now, would that still happen with footballers? I mean, I guess it has with Messi?
The early signs, and I know he's only a kid, but the early signs would suggest, and I may well be being very unfair in him, that Haaland doesn't have the necessary charisma to make the similar kind of impression. But as I say, he is just a child. So
Norway itself isn't in a soft state of flux and change that, say, Brazil was throughout Pelé's career or Argentina was throughout Maradona's career. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about the Salah effect in Egypt, that, you know, he's this iconic, transcendent figure, and I'm not kind of sort of expert on Egyptian politics, but I do wonder whether it's possible for a footballer to have that kind of transformative effect on a country. I don't see it happening with Haaland and Norway, but I think if the circumstances are right, then the means are certainly there. And you know, the way that great players are sort of beamed onto our screens and have their fame kind of spread worldwide makes those circumstances quite conducive, I think, to that sort of icon worship.
You can become that kind of person whether you want to or not. I mean, Jack Charlton had a similarly transformative effect in Ireland, and I suspect could have done without all the fuss, but because he was such a really nice guy, he went along with it. And, you know, it was a nice earner for him as well, but I suspect he was kind of a reluctant figurehead for socio-political change, but he was one nonetheless.
On the 7 minutes of VAR that we touched on, there's a quote from Gianni Infantino this week where he says about VAR, "Rather than taking things away, it adds, I would say, another layer of adrenaline in the game. Now, if there's a doubt, you check, you wait, you see, and that's the adrenaline that makes football how it is. the waiting for a result. A cynic writes, does Barry get the same adrenaline rush that Gianni Infantino gets while waiting for a VAR decision to be made?
No, I was doing the minute by minute of this game and I was a bit baffled as to what was going on. For it's done. It's probably decent if you're watching on TV. If there was a crowd in that stadium, they would not have had a clue what was going on. And they're the ones who would have paid a lot of money to be at the game, and it would have been very unfair on them. They would have been absolutely flummoxed, like, what is going on here? We have no idea.
Yeah, you're right. You're so right. Anyway.
But, sorry, football governing authorities don't care about fans. We know that. We knew that before VAR was introduced.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the weekend. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, the Premier League, Man City 5, Southampton 2. Tom said it's like a testimonial. Crazy scoreline, brimming with errors. What a spectacle. It was sort of, you know, the 6 o'clock game you just sort of have on, don't you, ahead of... It's just on while you're pottering around doing other things. But I enjoyed this one. Duncan Alexander stats. Southampton have conceded more Premier League goals in Manchester this season than Petr Cech did in 35 games in 2004-2005. Pep said Southampton were the best team City had faced this season for the first 20 minutes. The way they play is a present for the spectators who weren't there. But they were quite good, Mark, weren't they, Southampton, for 20 minutes? I liked how they approached this. It was really fun. And then City won.
Pep always praises teams that play perfectly for Man City to beat. He did that. He did exactly the same at Bayern Munich and at Barcelona. He always seemed to enjoy Rayo Vallecano's sort of ability to concede six at the Nou Camp, you know, because they play this wide open game rather than sort of six at the back. But I enjoyed watching Southampton, and in terms of the start they made, they were unlucky, really unlucky, I think, to be 3-1 down when they were, and then it was game over. I also think that Ralf Hasenhüttl is right that he'd rather play like that. I mean, Southampton are, you know, I don't see them as being in a relegation fight. They're in the lower end of the mid-table, but, you know, I would rather see a team play like that. I mean, if I supported a mid-ranking Premier League team, it feels like that there's more, I don't know, hope and ambition there in just playing in that sort of approach. And I also love the fact that he's given the FA Cup a really good go this season. I think it's been to the detriment of their Premier League form. They lost to Arsenal and to Wolves immediately after beating both teams in the FA Cup. So, again, I admire that. I want to see these mid-table teams trying to do something other than just exist. And I think that Southampton play a style of football that if I was a fan of them, I would enjoy. And you know that you're going to take the odd beating along the way. But give me that rather than sort of eight at the back and, you know, lumping it up to the big man and hoping to get a set-piece goal or something like that.
The odd 9-0, just one a year. I don't disagree with you, actually. City 14 points ahead of Manchester United. They need 18 points from their last 9 games to claim the title. This weekend, the North London Derby on Sunday. Man United West Ham Sunday looks like an interesting one. Leeds Chelsea might be fun. Sorry for using fun, Leeds fans. Palace West Brom. I feel like that is the Saturday 3 o'clock. I feel that's the Saturday 3 o'clock game every single week. Literally every single week. You go, there's the 3 o'clock one. I get Cambridge.
It feels like the BBC game. Yeah. it feels like the BBC one game. And Lineker's sitting there going like, oh, you know, great game, you know, just waiting for a goal.
Saturday, 3 o'clock game. I'll go and do something else.
Anyway, just would like to say well done to Dorking Wanderers' Jake Gallagher for doing the Kanchelskis jump and spin during a game against Eastbourne Town where no one was in about 100 yards of him. Do you remember the Kanchelskis one where it's not the one where he stands on the ball. It's the one where he literally is in the ball's in front of him. He just does like a 360 jump and then just carries on running. And it was very good of Jake Gallagher to
what end did he pull this move?
To no end, just because he could, you know. It's a bit like a goalkeeper making a great set dive for the cameras when a shot's going 100 yards wide. William says, sorry to bring this to your attention, but Jonathan Wilson made an error on Monday's pod.
Oh, please do bring it to our attention.
The swearing documentary about Brian Blessed couldn't keep his hand in iced water longer when swearing. As a frequent swearer, he is immune to the effect, whereas Stephen Fry, who isn't a frequent swearer, could. So this matters, says William, if you're still with me. I'm confused myself. It matters because what it means is footballers who get tackled and then roll around screaming will eventually be immune to the effect and therefore feel all the pain of the tackle. It's a bit like a boy crying wolf effect for histrionic centre forwards. Do you follow that, anyone?
I just agree with Jonathan on McDonald and Dodds and them not being very good. I've got no opinion on this, though.
All right. Jez says, would you rather have a football for a head or a referee's whistle for a nose that blows each time you breathe? Johnny?
Would I still have a brain inside my football head?
Yeah, yeah. And you can choose the ball.
Oh, yeah.
Would you have a normal nose on your football head or no nose at all?
I think I'm envisaging that it would just function like a head, but looking like a football. So, you know, presumably you'd breathe through some kind of membrane.
You'd breathe through the valve, wouldn't you?
Would I not speak through the valve?
Oh, that's a good point. No, you'd speak through the stitching of an old school stitch, like a 1960s. That would be the mouth.
How would we eat?
Through the stitching. And all you want to eat is air, Barry. You just need pumping up occasionally.
And would you need an orange one in the winter? Or would you be...
you have to go on a sunbed, don't you? Anyway, thank you, Jez. Glenn says, where does Kerry Gold rank in butters for Mark?
Oh, hi. Okay. I mean, I think, you know, we were talking about the Champions League earlier on. I mean, if you're doing coefficients in sort of butter, Kerry Gold would be right up there. Yeah, I don't... Barry might have a kind of more knowledge on how the Irish get their butter so good, but they certainly do. You know, when in sort of those tourist videos for Ireland, I think they should always mention how good their butter is. They never do, but they should.
Butter, every Irish tourism board promo video should have butter, red lemonade and Tato crisps.
No, the butter's fantastic. Kerrygold, one of my favourites for sure.
Matty says, have you ever had cabbage, Mark?
No. My granddad used to drink cabbage tea. Is that a thing? Water?
You've never had cabbage?
No, I haven't. No.
But how do you go through life without? I mean, they serve it at school. Like it's a staple of school.
Certainly didn't serve it in my school. I don't think.
Oh gosh.
Meat only school. And now Barry, I was having a meeting with the bosses, and you had talked to me about Football Weekly merchandise as a possible money spinner for us, hadn't you?
Yeah, I've raised this issue for years. I think it would be people would buy Football Weekly merchandise.
Could the listeners contribute ideas for what they'd like to get? I thought, you know, an inverting the pyramid paperweight would be quite a good... That would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm not sure how that would work, because you can't balance it on its point, its apex. So you would have to balance it the right way around, so it wouldn't be inverted. So I've already found a flaw in your first suggestion. It's stupid.
What about a craft beer called Buckheel? A pint of Buckheel?
I will not lend my name to any craft beer.
You're not lending your name. You're lending the name of what you think a Notts County centre forward is to the craft beer.
Well, I don't want to have any association with craft beer. I am against craft beer. It's horrible.
What if it makes us millions?
Then I could have my arm twisted. But I think we both know we won't be seeing any of this cash.
Oh, no, we're going into this. We're going into this with our eyes open, Barry. This is to make us money.
Okay, well, I'm prepared to endorse anything that will make me money.
Okay, if you have any ideas, we'll throw it open to you.
I mean, mugs, pint glasses, T-shirts, bespoke football shirts.
My sister-in-law, for Christmas one year, she got me, like, it was a CFAX mock-up of the 2019 Cricket World Cup final, as if like it was a CFAX page with a scorecard. And I don't know whether you could recreate classic Football Weekly exchanges, you know, on T-shirt form.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You know, the Barney Ronne Var rant down a T-shirt. Would anybody wear... Would you wear that? When would you wear
I wouldn't, but people... I mean, I certainly wouldn't, but there would be people out there who, I think... You know, people listen to this. People, you know, they press the play button and listen to this for an hour.
Yeah, they're still listening. Still listening at the end. Would you wear a Philippe Auclair beret? Is that
a foulard?
Oh, that would be nice, wouldn't it? A Lars Sivertsen sort of. He could do a series of ready meal sort of breakfast ready meals, couldn't he? A chopping board for Mark Langdon. There you go. Anyway,
this is the sort of banter we really want to be saving for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I noticed in your VAR rant, Johnny, you were talking, you know, when life was better, when the milk was delivered to your house. You see, that's the point. If the milk had been delivered to your house, you wouldn't have had to sieve out the muesli. That's why VAR should go.
Oh, gosh, touche.
There's a milk float still delivers on my street every morning.
And that's because, Barry, you're still in the 1970s, aren't you?
It wakes me up. But I don't know anyone who gets their milk delivered. It can't be a lucrative business to be in at the moment.
Producer Ian gets his milk delivered.
Yeah, my next door neighbour does. I've seen it on the porch.
Right, that'll do for today. I mean, I say that'll do. I reckon I could have said that maybe 10 minutes ago. But thank you anyway for your time. Thank you, Johnny Liu.
Thanks.
Thank you, Barry Glendenning.
You're welcome.
Thank you to the Racing Post's Mark Langdon.
Thank you, Max.
We will be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.